Welcome back to Get Psyched, brought to you by PsychSign. I'm your host, Arizu, and today we're diving into an important yet sometimes under-discussed aspect of mental health care, navigating the complexities of child and adolescent psychiatry in rural settings. Joining us today are Dr. Leah Cobb Snodgrass and Dr. Latoya Floyd, two remarkable psychiatrists who have dedicated their careers to addressing the needs of young patients in the rural landscapes of southeastern Kentucky and Montana. Their experiences weave a unique narrative, revealing the tangible challenges and innovative approaches involved in delivering psychiatric care in regions where it is very much needed, but also notably limited. In this episode, we're digging into the nitty-gritty of rural mental health care. We'll discuss how Dr. Snodgrass, Dr. Floyd, and professionals like them ensure that mental health services reach kids and teens in these areas, despite the limited support and resources. We'll explore the practical approaches they use and the real-world impact of their work in rural America. Get psyched for a thought-provoking conversation with Dr. Snodgrass and Dr. Floyd that will highlight the specific challenges and rewards of serving rural areas, as well as offering priceless insights for those of us who are both new and familiar with rural psychiatry and child and adolescent psychiatry. Welcome back, everyone, to the PsychSign podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. Today, we have a really, really special episode. We have two amazing guests joining here today. We have Dr. Leah Cobb Snodgrass, an ABPN board-certified physician in child and adolescent and general adult psychiatry, who serves as associate professor and chair of behavioral health at Lincoln Memorial University's DeBusk College of Osteopathic Medicine in Harrogate, Tennessee. She is a graduate of the University of Kentucky College of Medicine and completed her internship, residency, and child and adolescent psychiatry fellowship at Emory University in Atlanta. Dr. Snodgrass is a native of Middlesboro, Kentucky. She is clinically active, seeing children, adolescents, and young adults, and she is the proud mom of 17-year-old twin daughters, Alex and Alicia. We also have Dr. Latoya Floyd, who completed her medical school at Drexel University's College of Medicine in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and went on to complete her general residency there and was also chief resident. She completed her child and adolescent fellowship at the Yale Child Study Center with a focus on child trauma. She has a passion for community psychiatry and provided services as a medical director of an in-home program, psychiatrist in a community-based detention shelter, as well as psychiatrist in rural settings. On a personal note, she's obsessed with her Jack Russell Terrier, vintage fountain pens, and is developing a love of pottery. Thank you so much for being here today. I know that a lot of our listeners are interested in child and adolescent psychiatry, so this is going to be such a treat for them and hopefully also very helpful for them. But more than that, I think that many of our listeners, including myself, are also just have a general curiosity and interest in the field of child and adolescent psychiatry. And I think that in some ways, it kind of creates the foundation for what we know about adult psychiatry today. So I think that it's very valuable and pertinent information for any and all of our listeners. So I'm very excited to get into this topic so we can just jump right in. So this first question is for the both of you. What inspired you to pursue a career in child and adolescent psychiatry?
So I can field that one first. So, I went to medical school thinking that I was going to do some version of primary care. I really, really thought that I was going to be an obstetrician gynecologist. I did the first day on that rotation and realized that that was definitely not the job for me. I walked into the aftermath of a birth, not the birth itself, and was like, okay, this is so not what I thought it was. So that was the end of that. So then I started thinking about how much I like kids, have always loved kids, wanted to have kids. So I thought, you know, I would probably be a pretty decent pediatrician. So I sort of went that route for a while. I really stayed with that right up until I was writing my personal statement as a fourth year medical student. And I kept tripping over the line that said, this is why I want to be a pediatrician, because that did not ring true for me. I had no interest in pediatrics. I found it incredibly boring. So I had to take inventory of what I did like. And really what I liked about pediatrics were the kids who were non-compliant and non-adherent because their families were very dysfunctional, or just, you know, didn't have access. I liked kids that had learning disabilities. I liked kids who were eating disordered. I really did spend more time with the psychologist on the service than I did even with the doctors on the services when I was doing pediatrics. So that just kind of reinforced to me that maybe pediatrics was not my path, but pediatric psychiatry was. So I changed a few things in my personal statement. I contacted my letter writers and let them know, and I have never looked back.
Amazing.
I think for me, I also went into med school thinking something different and thought I would actually be a surgeon. I was actually interested in bariatric surgery, and I was on my sub-I, and I was super excited to be there. And he had the Da Vinci robot, and it was just what I wanted, or so I thought, until I met the psychiatrist that was doing the evals for the surgeon. And he understood so much without touching the person. He understood so much without cutting somebody open. I had never met anybody like that. And his questions were always just so thoughtful. And so I pushed that out of my mind and pushed forward because I wanted to be a surgeon. And I kept going back to that psychiatrist, and we had to scrub in on the patient and follow them through the support group. And the woman actually started drinking, and I did her intake, and I know that she didn't consume alcohol before. And so this pushed me back to that psychiatrist. And, you know, he's like, well, you know, she personifies food, and I think it's very calming for her. And he had such an understanding as though this wasn't a surprise that this might have developed. And so at that point, I, like Dr. Snodgrass, had to make some decisions. And I decided I wanted to be a psychiatrist. But again, it takes me a few turns. So I was my fourth year, I was moonlighting in a detention in a jail, an adult jail. And I didn't know that if there are a certain level of charges, children are automatically waived into the adult system and can be incarcerated with adults in certain states. And I was working in one of those states, and there was a 15-year-old that had committed an armed robbery and was actually in the jail. And attempting to understand what they were talking about with his family, like so many of that child's family members have been present, and just trying to understand the path of a 15-year-old to jail. And that really piqued my interest in the intersection between psychiatry and the law. So I thought maybe forensic psychiatry, but I wanted to see children. So then I did general psychiatry, finished my child fellowship, and decided I wanted to do more treatment. And so that's what kind of guided me to this path.
Wow. Thank you to both of you for sharing those responses and making them as personal as you did, because I do find that psychiatry can tend to lean in a more personal direction than some other areas of medicine, for better or for worse. Sometimes it's personal. And so I do appreciate those responses. And I wanted to highlight something you both kind of touched upon, was that neither of you came into medical school wanting to do psychiatry, but somehow found your way there. And now, well, from what I can only assume, you are very happy to be psychiatrists and very, very happy with your decision to kind of shift gears and go with what your gut was telling you. And maybe this isn't what I originally thought was my path, is actually not what's meant for me. And so I applaud you both for taking the leap and doing that. And I think that I hear that story over and over again when I talk to psychiatrists, that this wasn't something that was on their radar when they initially entered medical school. So I just love to hear those types of stories. Like, what was the moment that you realized psychiatry is for you? I love touching upon that, because not every, I for me personally, I came into medical school with an interest in psychiatry. And so far, I mean, I've only really fell in love with it even more. And so, I mean, I'm prepared to make a shift if that day comes, but I have just learned very, very recently, just in the last 2 years of medical school, that not everyone comes in with that, in that, on that same trajectory. And it's so cool just to see where everyone starts and where everyone ends up. And yeah, it's just a really beautiful thing about the specialty, that it just kind of calls to people and people answer that call. On another note, I know that working in psychiatry, it's not always easy. It has its own particular barriers and challenges. So for the both of you, what do you identify as the unique mental health challenges faced by children and adolescents in your respective regions? And how do you address those challenges?
I would say here, so I'm currently in rural Montana. And so I think that it's a very leveled approach. I think that one is access. We have certain counties in Montana that don't have a primary care. So one is, one of the largest challenges that we face is the ability to actually access care. I think when you look outside the system and start looking at the patient and the families, I think for me, it's child trauma. I think I live in a county, we have some of the highest removals by the Department of Children and Families. We have a lot of methamphetamine use and removals and addiction. And so when you have these parents that have this sense of they have their own needs sometimes that decrease their maternal and paternal preoccupation with their children, you've lost that treatment partner. And so I think that the inability to access care in general, plus needing to kind of look at it in a more holistic approach, and that you're not just looking at that child, you're looking at a family, and the ability to be able to pull the entire family into treatment, which is something that I've had to do here. So I would say access and child trauma are things that I face very much so here.
And I think here, so my practice is in southeastern Kentucky. It's right across the border from where my medical school is. We were ground zero. Like, we started with the opioid epidemic at least 30 years before it ever made the news, because we're in the coal fields of southeastern Kentucky. And as a result, there are some families in which we have already lost two generations of parents and caregivers to addiction. Some are dead, and some are just in prison, and some are just unavailable. Like, they just cannot reconcile being a parent or grandparent. So I think one of the biggest challenges that I face is I have an incredible number of grandparents and even great grandparents who are raising their grandchildren and great grandchildren. And as you can imagine, this is not what they envisioned for their, quote, golden years. And some of them are just barely hanging on by a thread. They have a 5, a 6, a 7-year-old who was in utero drug exposed with severe ADHD and learning disabilities and various other things. And they're just really struggling. Even a young parent would struggle in that situation. So I think one of the biggest challenges that we see is not having the biological parents and sometimes even the grandparents available to care for the children. Access is also a huge issue for us, the same as for rural Montana. I think any rural area has a significant lack of healthcare. We have plenty of primary care, though, where I am. Again, we're a little bit closer to a medical school, so we're good there. But I'm the only child and adolescent psychiatrist and the only psychiatrist for about 80 miles in a couple of directions and for about 50 miles in a couple of other directions. There's just not many of us. I only see kids a couple of days a week. So my wait list is about 4 months out. And as you can imagine, that's a huge barrier. If you contact my office and your child is in crisis and we tell you that we can see you in January, obviously that's not what you want to hear. So I think, yes, access and just the intergenerational loss of parents is what we're dealing with.
Yeah, I think it's so interesting to notice that in both of your respective regions, that addiction has certainly, it sounds like it certainly plays a huge role in the psychiatric needs of the populations there. And whether it's methamphetamine in rural Montana or an opioid crisis in Kentucky, the coal mining areas of Kentucky, I think it's so interesting to note that sometimes a lot of the issues just stem from the addiction. And something you touched upon, Dr. Snodgrass, is the exposure to substances in utero, and that being something that eventually down the line becomes manifests as developmental issues, or even intellectual disability, or even ADHD and things like that that you did mention. Certainly, very, very unique challenges, and I can only imagine, the number of people that need help and the lack of access that can't be matched to meet that need. It's certainly very sad. And I think it's part of the reason a lot of our listeners are probably interested in going into psychiatry. So I commend you both for working in this field. It's certainly not easy. You don't see easy things, and it's not like, working in other medical settings where you can just fix someone right away and send them out the door and they're all fixed up. It's something that requires patience and diligence and perseverance, because a lot of these patients are going to come back for a while. And also you might not get, you might not have success with a lot of these patients. So I commend you both. And I did want to ask you, Dr. Snodgrass, about your time as medical director at the Appalachian Regional Healthcare. What initiatives and programs did you implement while you were medical director?
So interestingly, this kind of comes full circle. It was many years ago, probably close to 15 or 16 years ago. So way before telemedicine and telepsychiatry was really a thing, that we were already implementing some telemedicine. So basically we were an interconnected system. So all of our hospitals had video conferencing, and we were seeing patients between hospitals. So we could do consults, and we could also even do inpatient care. So I was actually housed in Middlesboro in an office at that ARH, but I saw my inpatients 2.5 hours away at Hazards ARH. Now, interestingly, of course, we did this, but billing had not caught up to our technology at the time. So we actually did some advocacy and some lobbying at the state level to get some billing appropriated specifically for Medicaid and Medicare. So that was probably one of the more interesting things that I did while I was there. I would love to tell you that everything worked out great and we had billing parity and so on, but it took a little bit longer. But now, of course, telemedicine, telepsychiatry, obviously here to stay. But we were just a little bit ahead of the curve, interestingly, in that way.
That's very interesting. Yeah, I think now telepsychiatry and telemedicine is almost ubiquitous, right? Like you can get an appointment for the most part. In my experience, at least, it's you can try to get an interview with most specialists. But it's interesting that you guys were ahead of the curve, and it's actually such a huge accomplishment that you were able to do that for that particular population, considering the lack of access that they would have had prior to having options like telepsychiatry and telemedicine. So that is amazing work on your part. And I think it's something that deserves credit because advocacy is not necessarily something that is natural to us as physicians and physicians in training. I mean, we advocate for our patients on a daily basis, but on a broader, larger scale, I can only imagine it's stepping out of your comfort zone a bit.
But not much. I like to talk, and I like to talk about what my kids need and what my patients need. So it was pretty easy.
Beautiful. I love it. Dr. Floyd, you touched upon the trauma that you were seeing in these pediatric populations, and how that's kind of been the recurring theme in your career. In your experience, what has been the difference between practicing in a rural setting like Great Falls, Montana, compared with a more urban setting like where you trained in Philadelphia and New Haven?
I think that, you know, it's the lack of subspecialty. I think I was very much so spoiled. You know, you could find a child psychiatrist that only wanted to study early onset psychosis. And that person would, you know, have that expertise and you could funnel children into that clinic. I think that, you know, on more of a kind of looking at the families individually, they're actually not that similar to what you've already talked about, with what Dr. Snodgrass is experiencing in Kentucky with access and addiction and how it's decimating families, and what I'm experiencing here in Montana. I think the biggest issue is the continuity of care and the larger continuum of care. But the patient and the population and the needs are very similar. They're very similar. One of the things that I really have really tried to do is attempt to categorize it and make trauma screening more universal in our clinic and in our pediatric clinic, and attempting to partner with our pediatricians to make sure they actually have the ability to screen and metrics in order to identify this. Because I think that what we know is with trauma is, especially when things are happening in the peritraumatic period, they're not sometimes seeing me here. They're with the pediatricians. So attempting to create a dialogue with them and having them feel comfortable about asking these questions and having these discussions so we can better triage who gets to care and how they get there.
Absolutely. I think that's so, so important. And it's so amazing to hear that you made an effort to develop those interprofessional relationships with your local pediatrician so that they can screen for those childhood adverse events and kind of funnel them to the appropriate treatment centers so that you guys can tackle these issues before they exacerbate in the long run, when they're only that much harder to treat. I think that's such an amazing effort on your part. So I commend you for that. And it's actually a little surprising to hear that, maybe not surprising, surprising is probably not the word, but to hear that the needs were very similar in these two very, very different settings. It's not necessarily surprising. I'm just wondering if there were any, aside from what you kind of discussed, as far as like access to resources, and maybe like being able to subspecialize in something like early psychosis, were there, in the needs, was there anything that you noticed a difference in?
I would say that attempting to normalize, you know, I think there was not somebody in this chair as a child psychiatrist prior to me. There was a nurse practitioner, but then there was a vacancy. So I think that the discussion about mental health and talking about things in school and kind of being more open about issues that children are having, I think that was something that was missing, where in Philadelphia, I feel like mental health efforts are more in the forefront. I think it's something that was discussed a little bit more openly. I think building relationships is something my case manager would often go to the Department of Children and Families and sit in on the foster care review committee. And that's something that she did prior in her iteration of her life. But trying to create a multidisciplinary team and change the language around it and bringing things, because I think there has to be that psychoeducation with trauma about what it is, because I think that, at least for me, sometimes it wasn't high on the differential for others, but it was high for me. So I think bringing that discussion and making it more a part of the forefront is something that was a little bit different.
Absolutely. And I think that that's something that a lot of people don't think about, is like whether it is part of the mainstream rhetoric in a particular community to openly and upfront discuss some of these things. So thank you for identifying that and sharing that with us. I think that kind of puts a new perspective on what it's like to practice psychiatry in different parts of the country, for sure. I want to kind of shift gears just a little bit and talk about the brighter side of things, and talk about maybe the both of you could share some success stories or moments in your career that have been particularly rewarding or impactful as a child and adolescent psychiatrist.
So for me, I think it all comes down to when you see a patient achieve something that they would not otherwise have achieved if they did not have the appropriate treatment, the resources mobilized, the intervention that was necessary. So, you know, when my kids who really struggle graduate from high school, like we are so thrilled and just so over the moon for them. We just really try to celebrate them because that's something that may not have happened otherwise, right? And in the other realm that I'm in, which is academics, I really do celebrate when my medical students decide to go into psychiatry, because that's a huge win for me. Because obviously I'm never going to be able to see like thousands and thousands of patients. Maybe over my entire career, I'll see some, but all of the people that come through my medical school who are encouraged by me and who I can come alongside and mentor and advise, they're going to go all over the world and do amazing things. And I get to be a little small part of that journey. So I think those are the things that I'm proudest of.
I completely agree. I think that being present here on this podcast and having the med students interested in child psychiatry or consider it, or one of my favorites is when the med student chooses to stay behind and talk about a case or have a question. I find that completely gratifying that maybe this will be somebody that will, you know, another wonderful colleague in the field. I think for me here, one concrete success story that I had was being able to help a parent understand how their addiction was impacting their ability to be present for their child. And we had the ability at that time to move that parent toward treatment. And I was able to see the child change in a way that we were not able to operationalize strictly with dyadic work. Being able to have the child talk about the parent's addiction, the parent trusting, and in our team to be able to help them find resources and get treatment, and just watching the family change. And I think, and hoping that this is a generational seed that will continue. I think that was probably one of the most rewarding experiences I've had.
Yeah, I think that what you're both doing is amazing and beautiful. And the fact that you're actually out there changing lives, and yes, all physicians touch patients and change their lives and, you know, do their best to help serve their patients. But I think that maybe I'm a little biased, but I think that you as child and adolescent psychiatrists have a special opportunity, a privileged opportunity to be able to reach those folks in a way that maybe other people in the healthcare system can't. And so, I think it's amazing that you're, you know, utilizing your platform and your career to really change as many lives as possible. And I love that you have so many, that you do have success stories, you know, and that you celebrate them. More importantly, that you take the time to celebrate them and acknowledge them, because, I don't know, I mean, I'm barely starting out my career, but I can only imagine how frustrating it can get at times. When you don't have success stories, and when you don't have, when you have relapses and they need to come back for treatment, or they, you know, their story ends sadly, or a number of different ways it can go. So I think it's always important to celebrate those wins. And I think that looking forward to the future, there's so many things that maybe the next, your generation or the next generation of psychiatrists can do to make it so that there's more access to mental health care. But in both of your opinions, what policy changes or healthcare improvements can address the shortage of psychiatrists and improve that access to mental health care?
So, you know, I've thought about this, and I, of course, we always talk about incentivizing certain specialties. So that's a possibility. You know, maybe we could try to do something, whether or not that would be a federal movement, a state movement, I don't know. But that's possible. But really, there has to be a shift in the culture of medicine. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is, in the same way that psychiatry patients are somewhat stigmatized for seeking treatment, for whatever reason, psychiatry is somewhat stigmatized among medical specialties. And again, we are probably just as, if not more important when it comes to quality of life for almost every area of life. So I think that until or unless psychiatry is considered to be an equal pursuit, if not a more advanced pursuit, it's always going to be one of those things that young people, especially medical students who are drawn to it, but whose families expect them to be surgeons or pediatricians or family practice docs, it's always going to be a little bit tricky for them to navigate that, because then their families and uneducated people will say, but you're not going to be a real doctor. Mm. Well, in reality, we're going to be real doctors, and we're actually going to be the doctors that shine light into really dark places and help people come through really dark chapters in their lives in a way that no other specialty can. So that's what I see. I see that there still needs to be a shift in the culture of medicine. I'm very hopeful because millennials and Gen Zs are much more open and available about mental health. They're much better educated about mental health. So my hope is that your generation is going to just blow the roof off of all of that stigma and all of that cultural bias within medicine. So that's where I'm leaning and hoping.
I think I agree with a lot of what you're saying. I think that, you know, the ability to recognize psychiatry as an equal medical specialty is something that I think is evolving, and I hope it continues to evolve, because I think that understanding of it does deter people from maybe even pursuing the field. I think, you know, as with other things in medicine and different things, I especially think with child psychiatry, I think that some of the student loan reimbursement, because if you think about it, you're 6, you know, depending on whatever you've done with your training, whether you did 4 years of adult and 2 years of child, or whether you took another year and did research or took a chief year. I think incentivizing it with the loan repayments, and especially if you're going to work in public service, working specifically with Medicaid and Medicare population, I think decreasing some of the hurdles that specialists face in their training and getting their loans forgiven, I think that might do something for people that are in the specialty of general psychiatry, but thinking of moving on to additional studies and additional boards. And I think that would be helpful. But I do agree the mindset around psychiatry has to change. I think in order to allow people to have a true understanding of what the field is, because I still think it's very nebulous for some people.
Yeah, I completely agree with both of you. I think that there's, on the policy front, there's plenty that can be done, whether it's at a federal or state level, that can be done to either incentivize the specialty or, you know, do a bit more research into some of the subspecializations in psychiatry, just to develop the field a little bit more. Because it does deserve that attention, especially in recent years. We've seen a little bit of improvement about, you know, we've seen an actual discussion of mental health in mainstream media and in medical schools. Even we've seen like a bit more attention paid towards the wellness and mental health of students and physicians even. But I agree with both of you that there's not nearly enough done to shift the culture towards a direction where mental health is a bit more normalized. And more than that, the field of psychiatry is, brought to the place where it holds that respect that it deserves, because it is a highly scientific field. It is a highly, rigorous field. And I think that there are misconceptions about both of those things, that psychiatry is not rigorous or scientific, or equating psychiatry. In my experience, I've, explained to people that I want to be a psychiatrist. They equate it with maybe what a psychologist does, which is in some ways similar, but also in many, many ways very different. It's a little challenging, and I wouldn't say disheartening, but just a little frustrating trying to deal with those misconceptions. But I think that the people that are committed to coming into this field and becoming psychiatrists have what it takes to shift that narrative and educate people and do what it takes to, you know, change the culture and bring it to where it needs to be, to so that we don't have, you know, record highs of suicide rates, so that we don't have record highs of drug addiction. Because the more we neglect this issue and the more we don't give respect where respect is due, you're only going to see a worsening of these issues. So I think it starts with giving that respect to the providers and giving more opportunity and incentive to future providers. I wanted to ask you, Dr. Floyd, when you trained in Philadelphia, you were involved with the Assertive Community Treatment Team. Can you explain what that is and what your experience with that team entailed?
So I wrote for a mobile team for, at the time it was called Northwest Human Services. And we would go and we would visit the home of very psychiatrically fragile people that sometimes were not able to make it to a traditional outpatient clinic, or they needed additional levels of supervision. I think for me, the ability to be able to see people in the community has been particularly useful in the development of a treatment plan. When you see people in their home and with their family and in their natural environment, at times things that you take for granted in the office become very clear. I would often tell myself, like, oh, well, this is the box top to the puzzle. This is what I'm missing. This is why this person's not able to. I was able to, during my chief year, ride with the NHS mobile team in Philly, and it was highly rewarding. And again, it at that point in my career, it really helped me widen my vision of really what a patient needed in a more holistic way, how they were seen in their home, how they interacted in their community. And it really helped me understand the barriers to their care.
Absolutely. I think that, like you said, that provides such a different and unique perspective to what you see when you have a patient come to your office, providing that different kind of lens to what you typically see. And I think it speaks to what we just discussed about maybe having more programs like that, where it makes mental health care more accessible by actually going into the homes of patients that can't necessarily drive out to see a physician, or can't access the technology to get on a telepsychiatry appointment, or maybe needs a little bit more intensive care and attention. And I think that programs like that kind of address part of the issue, at least, and are probably programs that we should see a bit more expansion of. But I did also want to ask Dr. Snodgrass a little bit about your educational and professional journey. I know we touched upon it a little bit earlier. But your journey from an associate's degree to medical school and now a child adolescent psychiatrist, do you have advice for aspiring medical professionals who don't come from non-traditional, or who may come from non-traditional backgrounds?
I think never devalue the fact that you are non-traditional. It's actually quite attractive. I just spent several years on the admissions committee at my medical school. I finally cycled off last year. I have to say I'm kind of glad, because it was a lot of work. but at any rate, I did spend those years. And we loved it whenever there was an applicant who had not gone straight through college and directly into medical school. We thought it was actually fantastic to have been in the real world, to have worked, to have gotten some real life experience. We found that students who were a little older and who had a little more experience were usually more mature and really knew that this is what they wanted, and they were very committed and dedicated to it. So having been a non-traditional student and being a champion for non-traditional students, I would just say, again, you know, just know that there's value in every experience that you've had. And it doesn't even necessarily need to be that you worked in the medical field. Just, you know, work in general, you can learn from every situation in which you find yourself. And we just really, we think that those are sometimes the best medical students. So.
Yeah, I think even just among my classmates, we have a few who have had entire careers in law or in engineering and things like that, that have kind of made that career shift and pursued a new path of medicine a little bit later on in life. And I think I agree with you. It absolutely, they add so much value in coming into medicine that I don't think you can possibly undervalue, or it's not possible to overvalue it, rather, because it's sometimes I feel like when we're in working in medicine, it can be a bit of an echo chamber if it's always people with the same ideas and perspectives and experiences. So I think it requires bringing in people with a variety of experiences and you know, all kinds of things that they've experienced. And so I think that that's such an asset to medicine as well. But before we wrap up this conversation, I did want to make sure that our listeners got an opportunity to hear it directly from you guys. What you think, in your experience, what you think are the most essential qualities and skills that a psychiatrist should possess to make a meaningful impact on the lives of patients, particularly young patients and their families?
So for me, I think that you have to have a heart for children. You have to love children, not just love normal children. You have to love children who are struggling. You have to love children who come from homes that are not ideal. You have to love children who are disenfranchised and marginalized and who are living in poverty. So I think you have to have a heart for children who are in need. And I think through that, you have to be a compassionate person. And you also have to be a pretty darn good adult psychiatrist, because you are going to be working with those parents and you're going to access those children through those parents. And I believe that's one of the reasons that we are required to train in general adult psychiatry first, because it's well known that to access the child, you must be a great family psychiatrist. They're the product of their environment. And if we can't help change the environment, then we probably can't do much to help change the situation for the child. So I think you just, again, compassion, have a heart for them, and just, you know, stay committed. I also think it's really important to always be very, very positive when you're taking care of kids. Always see the glasses half full. You know, positivity is a bit contagious, and a lot of the kids that I see don't come from that. Everything around them is very negative and, you know, very, very doomsday oriented. So sometimes I may be the only kind of person who really sees the silver lining in the clouds in their lives. So I think that's important too, just to stay really strong, really positive, and just, you know, again, hopefully infect them with some of your positivity.
I don't know if I can follow Dr. Snodgrass's answer. I think it's amazing. I think, you know, you definitely have to have a love of children and families. I would say you also have to keep your own curiosity as it to people and not assume, and really be part of their journey with them in a very curious way so that you can help guide them and scaffold change. I do agree that the ability to reflect positivity is important, and optimism. I think also is there are wonderful things about our field, but there's also things that we can be exposed to vicarious trauma very easily. So I think the ability to persevere and endure and keep a focus on your own resilience and your own resilience factors as you move with these families is important, because allowing yourself to come to the table helps me as a psychiatrist, bringing all the things in my experiences, not only as Dr. Floyd, but as LaToya, right? But I think that it also allows me to be very porous sometimes to families and having to be mindful of that. But I do believe that everything Dr. Snodgrass said is important, but I would only add being curious and also tending to your own resilience so that you have longevity in your work. I think that as we go, we develop such an amazing skill set, but it's important to also make sure that aspects of ourselves are also nurtured and that you're a person that can also do that while you do the work, because that will add to the longevity of you doing the work, which will create more success in the end.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that you covered all the bases, I think, of what makes a really great and successful psychiatrist and child and adolescent psychiatrist. And I appreciate that you added that part about focusing on your own resilience as well, because I think that as healthcare providers, we're very much giving and we want to help as many patients as we can. But it's also important that we can't help to recognize and understand that we can't help anyone else unless we help ourselves first. And we need to make sure that we're not, like you said, like vicariously affected by some of the things we're exposed to and dealing with. And so I agree, it's very important to like take care of yourself first and foremost, know how to take care of yourself. And also, just show up for your patients as well, because it sounds like they really, really need it. I wanted to pose a last final question to you both. What final words of wisdom do you have to medical students and young psychiatrists who want to make a difference in disadvantaged areas?
My word would be to go for it. I think that obviously there's so many different ways that you can impact communities that are in need. As a psychiatrist and specifically as a child and adolescent psychiatrist, I often tell my students that are looking at psychiatry as a specialty that, you know, the world is truly their oyster. Like they can do pretty much whatever they want to do. But for those who are in particular looking to work with populations that are underserved and underrepresented, that's a very, very powerful way of approaching psychiatry. And I just feel like that, again, if your heart is there, then you should definitely follow it, see it through, and you will never regret it.
You know, I think that one of the things that we began talking about was, you know, the call to psychiatry or the call to anything. I think it's the important thing is to really be true to yourself and what your interests are. And that can be really hard when you're, you know, looking at positions and, oh, this is a better place for me, or this, I want to get tenure, or I want this grant. Making sure that the things that you're devoting yourself to are things that are truly fulfilling and bring you joy and bring you ease. And I think inside that, the ability to help will just manifest. And I know that sounds very hokey, but I do. I think if you find something that you're truly passionate about, you will find a way, and you'll find a way to make a change. And if it's something you're passionate about and that fuels you, you will. I think it's also important to understand that, at least for me in my stage in my career now, I have no idea what has been impactful. Things that I thought were impactful, I don't know if they were, and things that, you know, I hoped to be maybe had a small in. And I may not know to the very, very end and tippy top of my career, like what was truly. And so I think if you focus yourself on doing the best you can for children and families, but also doing the best that you can to develop your skill set and, and disseminate change, you will find success. And you'll find that you will have a larger end than you probably could have imagined.
Well said, both of you. I wholeheartedly agree with what you said, especially that last part there, Dr. Floyd, about following what matters to you and pursuing what matters to you, what you're passionate about. If you truly, truly want to make a change in a particular area, in a particular cause, following that, and opportunities will manifest, they will arise. And if they don't, you can create your own opportunities. I mean, we live in 2023. You can do anything you want, really. And so if the opportunities aren't there, create them. And so I think it takes a generation of people that truly have that laser focus to be like, I can affect whatever change I want to see. I think that's great advice for our listeners. And I wanted to thank you both again for taking the time to have this conversation with me and share your experiences and share them with our listeners, who I hope learned as much as I did during this conversation. Thank you again.
Thank you for having us. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much. I think this hopefully will open the door for somebody to understand the field a little differently.
Absolutely. Well, thank you all for listening. Bye.
Bye.